Welcome back to the program. According to the Center for Disease Control, we are in the midst of an influenza pandemic that began in April of this year. We're going to spend some time right now looking back at another pandemic, one that happened in 1918. It was the deadliest plague the world had ever witnessed, and even by the most conservative estimates, resulted in a worldwide toll of 21 million deaths. We're going to talk about it this morning with my guest, John Barry. He's the author of a book entitled The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. John Barry, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks
great,
for having me.
Great to have you here. It is remarkable that today, with all of the things that modern science and modern medicine has to offer us, that we still look upon the flu as a potentially deadly pandemic. Talk a little about that.
Well, it's viruses are difficult to deal with, and as much as medicine has improved, we have yet to figure out a way of defeating influenza other than the vaccine. You know, there really is no treatment other than palliative care.
Right. Talk about 1918, the pandemic there, how it got started.
Well, all influenza viruses actually start in birds. There is no such thing as a naturally occurring human influenza virus. But it mutates so rapidly, it gives it more than practically any other virus the ability to jump species. So it's done this historically as far back as we can look, at least 10 times in the last 300 years, and four times, well, actually five counting the present one, since 1889. So it's not an unusual occurrence. The best evidence, I think, suggests that it actually started in Kansas, although there are other hypotheses. And, you know, because nobody's immune system has been exposed to a new virus after it jumps species, it spreads explosively. The current situation is a little bit different because, first, people who were born before 1957 have had exposure to a cousin of the present virus, so they have some protection. And it's also possible that people who were vaccinated in the swine flu scare of 1976, when there turned out not to be a pandemic, but 40 million were vaccinated, they may have some protection. And, you know, there are some disputes over whether, anyway, the net result is that the current pandemic, at this point anyway, seems like it may be the mildest that we know about in history.
And is that because of something that we're doing? Is it because we're more effective in quarantining and treating and vaccinating? Or is it something inherent in the flu itself?
It's entirely inherent within the virus itself. You know, long before we got any vaccine into the population, it had already established it's, you know, standard operating procedure. And it's almost, however, like two entirely different diseases. The overwhelming majority of cases are mild, like seasonal flu. But there is although a distinct minority, in that minority, the virus behaves with great virulence, very much, actually, like the 1918 virus. So it's a bizarre, you know, manic depressive type situation. The overwhelming majority of mild cases, but that small minority, it's a very dangerous virus in that small minority. I think the latest death toll by CDC is upped it now to 10,000 deaths, and you know it is just early December or mid December. So you know that's not nothing, particularly since the normal seasonal influenza kills the overwhelming, you know, over 90% of the deaths are elderly, and most of those are 85 years old and older, so they're quite elderly. Mm-hmm. Whereas these deaths, as probably your listeners already know, are in the young. It's in although most of them have some comorbidity, there's, you know, a very significant number of people who are completely healthy and young who are dying. And that makes this something to pay attention to, even though the gross numbers are not as scary as it might otherwise be.
What is it inherent in the virus that causes some to spread so much more virulently than others?
Well, you've got two issues. One is the spread between people, and that's a function of whether your immune system has some defense against it, and the other is once it gets into somebody. Now, seasonal influenza, the virus, that virus does not have the ability to bind to cells in the lung and infect cells in the lung. This virus, the pandemic virus, can infect cells directly in the lung, and that makes it virulent. That mm-hmm. means in this small minority of cases where it is behaving with great virulence, they are starting out with viral pneumonia, and that is not a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. To what extent are there similarities between the current H1N1 strain and the pandemic that took place in 1918?
Well, in terms of the virus itself, there seem to be a lot of similarities. For one thing, the original H1N1 virus was the 1918 virus. But beyond that, the targeting young people, healthy young people, was a signature of the 1918 virus. And, the whole demographics, the fact that, the young populations are being most attacked is both pandemics. The ability of the 1918 virus and this virus to bind to cells deep in the lung is also similar, although in 1918 that happened, a lot more often than is currently occurring.
Mm-hmm. In the 1918 epidemic, talk about what people did to protect themselves. Many of the things that you write about were really totally ineffective, but they seemed like they made sense at the time.
Well, actually, I've gotten a little bit, and more than a little bit, actually, involved in the preparedness effort in the last 5 years in planning what to do when a pandemic struck, because a lot of that, those plans, the most obvious and well-publicized action being school closing, a lot of those plans were based on what cities in the United States did in 1918, where there have been several studies trying to correlate what action cities took and how the course of the epidemic was in those cities. So we have looked at that. Frankly, I'm less enthusiastic about some of those actions than some other advocates of them are, because I think the evidence from 1918 is far more mixed than they're willing to credit. But it's certainly clear that something like school closing will at least briefly tamp down the pandemic. The question is it worth the cost, and how much will it tamp it down? And, when we were unsure how dangerous this virus was, based on the modeling and studies of 1918, in the spring, CDC, as people will recall, was recommending closing schools. But in the middle of that, and actually just after they took a very aggressive position, about 72 hours after a new, very aggressive position, there was a lot of pushback, including from me, frankly, and mm-hmm. And they reversed themselves. However, if this were a more dangerous virus, if larger numbers of people were getting the virulent form of the virus, then the cost-benefit equation changes, and you would reconsider that decision.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the global spread of the 1918 virus and how that spread globally compared to today when there's so much more travel and so much more opportunity for that kind of global spread.
Well, as an historian, I kind of have a little bit more perspective. People think that air travel's changed everything, and with some diseases, that's the case. However, there were pandemics, as I say, throughout history long before air travel, you know, when it took 8 to 10 weeks to cross the ocean, at least, like in 1698, a pandemic made it from Europe to New England. And in fact, influenza had crossed earlier. In 1918, there was plenty of travel, most of it commercial, but it spread very rapidly throughout the world and to essentially every country in the world and every island in the middle of the Pacific, whether they were involved in the war or not. So I think the emphasis on air travel is a little overdone. I also think that even if it were an extremely dangerous pandemic, the idea of thermal screening of passengers at airports and things like that are, you know, just ridiculous steps to take. You know, I also think there's very clear evidence from 1918 that quarantine doesn't work on this disease. You know, one of the main reasons is that infect people when you have no symptoms. You don't even know mm-hmm. that you're sick, nor could anybody else determine that you're sick, and you're still able to infect people. So, I mean, that's the main reason quarantine won't work, but also because, you know, take an airport screener, for example. You'd have to quarantine everybody who went onto the plane to clean it. You'd have to quarantine all the FedEx packages and so forth, and nobody's proposed anything quite that extreme.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the 1918 pandemic and how they tried to treat it medically at the time.
Well, they had, of course, very little, not quite nothing. For those deaths that were the result of complicating bacterial infections, pneumonias that followed influenza, they actually had developed both a vaccine and a serum treatment for the most common bacterial pneumonias. And if you were to get a shot today, a vaccine against bacterial pneumonias, what you're getting is a straight-line descendant from something that was developed in 1918 by one of the main characters in the book, a guy named Oswald Avery, who in fact is one of the most amazing scientists in American history and probably the single person most deserving of the Nobel Prize who never won it. I mean, one of his discoveries as a direct result of the influenza pandemic, he started studying the pneumococcus in 1918. They didn't know what caused the pandemic. And as a result of that, 25 years later, he discovered that DNA carries the genetic code. But back to your question. So you had all sorts of other treatments that, you know, some that might theoretically work, and maybe there was some evidence that it worked, and that would be blood transfusions from survivors and use of their serum in people who were very sick. They basically, you know, science, I mean, it's part of what the book's about, is how science, how medicine had become scientific in an mm-hmm. amazingly short period of time, really, really just about 20 years prior to the outbreak of the pandemic. U.S. medicine had been the worst in the world, in the developed world, and it, in almost amazingly in that short period of time, became equal to the best in the world. And, you know, so every hypothetical, theoretical idea that people could, you know, come up with, it was pretty much tried. And, you know, I mentioned a couple of the things that actually might have done some good. Well, clearly the vaccines and serum for bacterial pneumonia did some good. They were not that widespread, however.
What extent did population density play in the spread of the flu?
Well, of course, that's a very good question. And, you know, there's some pretty clear correlation between the number of people per room in a household and how many people in that household got sick. So, obviously that gets into socioeconomic factors. So, you know, but that's equally true today, certainly. You know, the closer contact you have with somebody, the more likely it is that the disease will be transmitted.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you talk about is how a lot of the initial spread was in the Army, in the military.
Well, that's true, sure. In the barracks situation, you obviously had a high density of people, and it became, you know, that disease targeted people who were in exactly the age group of army, of, you know, soldiers fighting the war. So it certainly spread rapidly in army bases. For example, when the virus went through a community, it usually took 6 to 10 weeks for a virus to enter a city, and, you know, within 8 or 10 weeks, it's in pretty much infected everybody, or everyone's been exposed to it, and then it dies out. In the Army, that same process, you know, it took about half that time to go through a camp of 50,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good example of it.
You mentioned Avery before. Talk about the other players that really profoundly impacted the medicine in general, science in general, as a result of the 1918 pandemic.
Well, not so much as a result of the pandemic, but leading into what I tend to write about is not necessarily science. I'm interested in how a society works, how power works within a society. So what I was focusing on in this book was how people who had some control over events, or at least thought they did, would confront the disease. And, you know, that's on the one hand political leaders who might institute quarantine or something like that, and on the other hand, and the primary focus was scientists who, for the first time, could apply modern methods to confronting this problem. And if you think that science in 1918 was primitive, you really need to rethink your position. I mean, one of the characters in the book, although, you know, albeit a minor character, won the Nobel Prize in 1966 for work that he actually did in 1911. So he was 55 years ahead of the curve. Another, Paul Lewis, who's a major character in the book and really a tragic figure, he proved polio was a viral disease in 1907, and in 1908 produced a vaccine 100% effective in protecting monkeys against polio. And it was almost 50 years before we could move that to people. So these were really outstanding scientists. And another figure was, and one of the largest figures, probably the single most influential figure in the history of American science, not just medicine, would be William Welch, who almost single-handedly transformed American medicine. He was also, you know, the president of the National Academy of Sciences and basically the president of every organization that he ever, you know, crossed the threshold with that organization. Just an amazingly large figure, although he personally never really developed any, you know, great, and had never was a leader in discovering things, but he was a great teacher and inspirational force, almost an impresario of science.
One of the places that you talk about is Rockefeller University and the role that it played. Tell us a little about that, John.
Well, you know, that became really the model for what is now the National Institutes of Health. And Rockefeller, of course, set up, which was somewhat ironic considering his own religious beliefs versus, you know, in he liked homeopathic medicine, but he created, he funded what was then called the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. And it quickly became the best place in the United States and equal to any in the world for research. And it was incorporated entirely, you know, to, so that its scientists wouldn't be drafted. The Army simply, under Welsh's influence, simply incorporated the Rockefeller Institute. It became Army Laboratory Number One. There was no Laboratory Number Two. So that protected everybody in there from being drafted, and they can, and Avery was there, and Peyton Rouse, the guy who won the Nobel Prize in 1966 for his work in 1911, whom I mentioned earlier, Simon Flexner, pretty interesting character, himself. You know, there was just an extraordinary amount of great scientific research going on there. Welsh had helped create it. He had been offered the first directorship, but he declined. He handpicked Flexner. Welsh was at Johns Hopkins and was the first dean of the medical school at Johns Hopkins. So, I mean, there was such leadership in all of these people. And, of course, they were all human, and they had their foibles and flaws and so forth.
What about the fear that permeated the country and the world at the time of the pandemic in 1918, and what can we learn from that?
Well, I think one of the most important lessons from 1918 is that when you're in a crisis situation like that, communication is extraordinarily important, and it's not just communication, telling the truth is extraordinarily important. You know, we were at war, and in order to keep morale up, the government pretty much decided they would lie about the pandemic and try to reassure people. This didn't work very well because some of the, I mean, they were saying, this is a direct quote from the Surgeon General, "You have nothing to worry about if proper precautions are followed." And another national public health leader said, "This is ordinary influenza by another name." It was called Spanish flu. But the fact is, some people were dying less than 24 hours after the first symptoms. They were dying with horrific symptoms, including bleeding not only from the nose and mouth, but from the eyes and ears. So people very rapidly learned, you know, whatever they were being told, that this was not ordinary influenza by another name. And when they were being lied to, the recognition that they were being lied to meant that they couldn't trust anybody or couldn't believe anything they were being told. They weren't stupid. And the result of this breakdown in trust was that, frankly, in many places, society almost began to break down. It got so bad that you would find, not only in cities, but in rural areas where neighbors and family was supposed to be really important and was really important, that some people would be starving to death, not because there wasn't enough food, but because everybody was afraid to bring them anything. You know, this got so bad that Victor Vaughn, who had been the dean at the University of Michigan Medical School and was, during the war, head of the Division of Communicable Diseases for the Army, he said, if this continues for a few more weeks, civilization could easily disappear from the face of the earth. He said that at the peak, and, of course, things calm down after that. Obviously, civilization didn't disappear, but that will give you a sense of how severe some of the problems were. And I think that was a direct correlation between the lies and how well society did or didn't function. In the few cases where the leaders of the community told the truth, those societies did seem to function. I mean, you had good reason to be afraid, but that doesn't mean that there's panic. I mean, for example, in San Francisco, the mayor, head of the unions, head of the business community, basically every leader in the city put their name on and endorse this full-page, huge print ad in the newspaper saying, wear a mask and save your life. Now, the fact is, a mask didn't do any good whatsoever. However, that is a very different message, wear a mask and save your life, than hearing somebody say, this is ordinary influenza by another name. And San Francisco did function, and people didn't starve to death in San Francisco because someone else, and they couldn't find anyone with anyone with the courage to deliver food.
Mm-hmm. How did healthcare workers fare in that epidemic?
They were extraordinarily heroic. There are very, very few records of healthcare workers fleeing their jobs. There are many. Constantly you see volunteers show up at a hospital and they show up for one shift and then they're never seen of again. But the healthcare workers were there and many of them died. Of course, in 1918, if you went into healthcare, if you were a physician or a nurse, then you knew one of the risks you were going to take was exposing yourself to an infectious disease because they were the number one killers. Today it's different. Today, at least in the United States, death from an infectious disease is quite unusual. People die from cancer and heart attacks and stroke and things like that. It's very unusual for a virus or a bacteria to kill someone. And obviously AIDS is you can't catch from treating somebody. So the whole circumstance today is different than in, one of the issues that surfaced with SARS a few years ago was whether healthcare workers would in fact show up when the threat was infectious disease. And it wasn't necessarily their own lack, courage, concern for themselves, but, do they want to go home and risk their families? And carry that infection with them. And frankly, because this virus so far has been mild, we haven't really had to test to find out what's mm-hmm. going to, how we would behave this time around.
And finally, what is the future fear of infectious diseases and new strains and new viruses out potentially out there?
Well, about 4 years ago, the then U.S. Surgeon General said that we've essentially conquered infectious disease and we have nothing to fear from them. Obviously, nobody would say that today. We do have concerns about new diseases, not only HIV, but, there are other threats, and there are other threats to the U.S., I think most people would say that dengue will probably eventually get to the United States, at least parts of it where the mosquitoes can, those tropical mosquitoes can transmit it. This is not the last pandemic. There will be, from influenza, there will be future influenza pandemics, and in fact, both in 1918 and 1957, every pandemic we know about in any detail has come in waves. They've all had at least three waves, and four or five, depending on how you count, for several of them. The 1889 pandemic, actually a wave that came 2.5 years after the virus first surfaced in the population, was by far the deadliest. And which is kind of puzzling because by then you would have figured everyone in the world would have been exposed and they would have had some immune protection. But in fact, the virus likely changed a little bit enough to become more dangerous, not less dangerous. And that was the third or fourth time around the world that last wave. In 1918, the second wave was the deadliest, but there was a third wave. The second wave came in 1918. September to November, then there was a third wave in January, from January to March, which was also quite deadly. In 1957, it was the same timing. There was also a pretty severe, September through November, 1957 was a major peak in pandemic activity. Then again, January to March, it was another peak, not quite as severe, but pretty severe nonetheless. So I would urge any of your listeners who are not yet vaccinated against this pandemic virus to get vaccinated. I certainly am.
Is there the possibility down the road of a broad spectrum vaccination, given the basic similarities in so many of these viruses for influenza?
Yeah, there's been enough work done in that area to suggest that it is possible eventually to develop a vaccine against that will work against all influenza viruses. And if we achieve that, then obviously the threat of influenza will be enormously diminished. There's also the possibility of, in fact, not only possibility, if this pandemic had hit 3 or 4 years from now instead of right now, the speed of production of a vaccine would be enormously, advanced, so we could make a vaccine in a much shorter period of time. So that's another significant advance. We're almost at that one. Getting a universal vaccine, that's a much harder problem and probably attainable, but it's not a guarantee.
John Barry, the book is The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. It's just out in paperback from Penguin. John, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.